Hi, I'm Jill Trebilcock, and welcome to the third in a series of very special shows produced by Stephen Roberts from Stephen Roberts Live on Cancel the Cabal and April Rain's We Raw Radio. So welcome to Jill Trebilcock Live. I first discovered today's brilliant guest, a true Renaissance man, Professor Stuart Twemlow, whilst researching teachers who bullied students. Stuart Twemlow is a psychoanalyst and psychiatrist who has for 40 years worked in communities researching and managing the causes of violence and ways to promote peace in consultation with schools, cities, corporations, the FBI and governments in third world countries. Stuart is on the teaching faculty of Houston, Texas for psychoanalytic studies. He retired in 2011 from working as a senior psychiatrist at the Menninger Clinic and professor the Menninger, or it might be Menninger, it's Menninger, Departments of Psychiatry, Baylor College Medicine, Houston, Texas. Professor Twemlow is visiting professor, University College London, member of the American College of Psychiatrists and Distinguished Life Fellow of the American Psychiatric Society. He's a founding editor of the, or he is founding editor of the International Journal of Applied Psychoanalytic Studies, and has written over 200 articles, books, and book chapters. In 2012, Professor Twemlow received the Sigourney Award for contributions to psychoanalysis. Dr. Twemlow is active in sponsoring educational programs and establishing community-based psychoanalysis within the International and American Psychoanalytic Associations. Many of his ideas are derived from a lifelong study and practice of the martial and meditative arts, which has me really fascinated. He's a seventh degree black belt and master teacher, a Renshi, in Kenpo Karate and Kabudu weapons. So watch out, I think, and a student of Zen and an exhibited black ink paint brusher. Welcome, Professor Twemlow. Professor Stuart Twemlow. Says Jill Twebilcock.
I like that combination of Twemlow, yeah.
Quite
So you want to talk about undiscussables.
I
think
I do.
It's a topic in schools and almost everywhere. You know, we're free-reigning, so I'm going to be free-reigned. I just finished, before you and Stephen called me, writing an introduction to a paper on gun violence in the United States. As you know, you don't know as an Australian, you do, Stephen, as a United States citizen, that we face serious issues with guns. And, you know, I'm sure you've seen, and we don't need to repeat all of the extraordinary, horrifying school shootings, including the recent one in Connecticut. I mean, it's just unbelievable. So, okay, the issue is, why do we do that? Switzerland is a country that issued a rifle, a military-style rifle, not just a hunting rifle, killing rifle to every citizen to keep in their homes and have no trouble with the sort of violence we do. The question is, why does the United States have this violence? Now, let me connect this with undiscussables. In this country, violence is undiscussable. It's connected
yes.
to the Second Amendment that says you can have a bazooka if you want to. In Australia, it's connected with the idea that teachers are perfect, delightful people that are only there to educate their children and never would think of hurting their children, mm-hmm. which is false. The first contact you had with my work had to do with identifying teachers who are very unpleasant to students.
Mm-hmm.
So undiscussables means things that people want to avoid talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as a psychoanalyst, I don't mind that. Of course, I don't mind that because I've that's why I make a living. I call myself a garbage collector of the mind. people, things that people don't want to discuss, talked with me about them every day.
Mm-hmm.
The issue I have with, like, violence in school is that if teachers are violent, then children will be hurt. And not only that, seriously hurt. Mm-hmm. It's not just like you or I who have had an unpleasant spat with a past spouse. We may have done something bad, like engage in domestic violence, and it's contained within the family.
Mm.
A teacher abuses a child by bullying, it has rampant, widespread impact, not only on the child who's being bullied by a teacher, but also all the other children who are sitting watching that happen.
Mm.
And wondering to themselves if an adult can really be trusted. And that trust issue is, can my parents even be trusted?
Mm.
That's just one example of why undiscussables in schools involve things like teachers who bully students.
Mm.
Students who bully teachers. That occurs in the United States in high schools, where I was in a high school where I saw a teacher grab a kid by the neck and slam him against the wall, if this is in a school, lifting his feet off the ground and telling him, don't you ever do that again, and then dropping him to the floor where he collapsed.
Mm.
And I talked to the teacher and I said, what were you trying to achieve with that? He said, I was trying to teach that kid not to do that again. Now, this was a school where nobody was allowed out in the playground because there were syringes and needles all over the playgrounds from drug users. So it wasn't safe for children to walk there. And it wasn't safe for young children to be out because pedophiles were cruising the school.
Another undiscussable.
Another undiscussable, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, teachers get caught. In that particular school, the library, if you went in there, it was stinking. The books were all damp and rotting. Nobody went in there. When I went into teachers' break rooms, all the teachers were asleep. Why were they asleep? Because they were so stressed that they might not get through the whole day without serious injury.
Mm.
Now, I understand that's an extreme. That's not the usual thing.
Well, maybe.
It's typical, you know, in white affluent schools, there's enormous bullying of children by parents who try and control teachers, by teachers who don't know how to respond to parents. And the kid gets caught in the middle of all of that and loses respect for both teachers and parents. And it results in one affluent school I was in Chicago that had a very big high school with 4,000 students on two campuses. This school, in a seminar we had six of the top students in the school, all of whom were girls, saying in chorus, I hate the school and I hate learning. And during the discussion, one of them said, I'm going to Harvard. Each one of these girls had got into an Ivy League school, which in America, Jill, means basically Harvard, Yale, Stanford, the usual. And she said, I'm going there and I'm going to fail out the first year and it'll cost my father about $75,000. And then I'm going to flip burgers because I hate learning. What sort of stuff does, it doesn't promote learning, it inhibits learning.
Oh, look, Stuart, I really have something to add here because this is why I got so interested in it. And so I'll talk quickly because your time is important. My oldest son actually got attacked by a teacher And it cost him. I went to the school and said, "Your teacher's just kicked my son." And they said, "Oh no, my teacher would not kick your son." And I said, "Well, he did. He has a hematoma on his leg." And my son ended up getting expelled from the school. This is in Dalesford Primary Secondary College years ago. And then later on, I had this second son at school, and he was being bullied by a student. And I kept a diary because I was a wake up to how schools close ranks.
Yeah.
And sure. And so I kept a diary on it. And then I went to the school and I said, "Well, this boy has been bullying my son. And here's the diary on it." I got my son to keep it. And then they said, "Oh, well, we'll sort this out." And then I happened to be at the school and they had this big glass room called the fishbowl. And I'm walking past the fishbowl and I see the disciplinarian there really bullying the student who'd bullied my son.
Yeah.
And I went up to her later and I said, "I didn't ask you to bully the bully." And then that cost him his schooling. So this teacher bullying cost my son and my neighbour's son, both of them, their schooling. My oldest son, yeah. And so this is why when I had to do some research at uni, I thought, well, I want to get into teachers who bully students. And so that's how I found you.
Well, let me tell you what I agree with. That's not unusual. Matter of fact, school violence legislation in America allows the victim and the bully to be equally punished. They're both suspended. They're both punished equally.
It's ridiculous.
It is a total distinction between the contribution. And then they mediate the dispute, which is the wrong way to do it, because mediation implies both people in the mediation.
Oh, my second son won that conflict, but yeah, the first one got kicked out. That got kicked by the teacher. The right. Second one, we survived. Right. He ended up school captain or vice captain.
Yeah. If they don't treat the victim and victimizer as different, it's a different sort of negotiation. It won't work. And I'm involved right now in the middle of a forensic case, which involves exactly the same thing. It's still occurring in America, where the child who is a victim was treated badly by the school system, just exactly like the victim was. Mm. This particular child ended up brain dead after an attempted suicide.
Mm.
So what I'm saying
Suicide is another undiscussable.
Well, I mean, let's get on to other things.
Mm.
Let's just say suicide that comes from school actions is undiscussable, and that's one of the reasons why it finds its way to the media, and the media then indicts the school, and the school gets on the defensive, and then nothing eventually happens very much. I mean, the fact is, the good thing that's happening in the United States is, number one, schools are realizing that targeted programs like anti-bullying, anti-learning disability, pro-mental health, in other words, picking up children who are different and putting them into special classes or special training it does not work.
Right.
Unless the child is integrated into a school as a whole under the umbrella of school climate, there's nothing useful that happens, because if you take a kid with learning disability and put them in, as occurred in one in the school I actually described to you, the one with the big, with 4,000 students, all the learning disabled kids were in the basement. And they had different recess times, they had different lunch times, they had different everything times.
Mm.
They never saw
which isolated them.
School. Yeah. That doesn't work.
No.
The government of the United States is just beginning to buy into that, just very gently. This week, there were a number of states who were told by the government to stop issuing criminal violations to children who cause trouble in a classroom or decide to skip school one day. These kids end up with criminal violations because police issued the tickets. And that's now been stopped. there's some attempt to see that these sort of undiscussable violations are utterly ludicrous.
Yeah.
But we have a number that are still there in right under the surface that are not being attended to. And I, if you want to, I'd like to bring up some of those.
I'd love to. So long as it's undiscussable, I want you to discuss it, or what? Us to discuss it, and just point out just that people need to become aware. You know, people might, you know, what, why they are taboos, and yeah, and just start talking about these undiscussable topics.
Now, one of them is money.
Right.
You know, money.
As yep.
American financier said, what else is important?
Yes.
Only money. So if you have wealthy parents, and you have very poor parents, that makes a huge difference on how you're seen in the school.
Status.
The sort of shoes you buy. See, kids here can buy Nikes for $175. Now, I don't think anybody would consider that reasonable for a pair of gym shoes, but it is what people pay.
They used to be really cheap there too.
Of course.
In America. Yeah, so they've really gone up.
Yeah, they've gone up because Nike makes money out of them.
Mm.
And the issue now is that poor kids don't wear Nikes and rich kids do. And so money is a huge issue. Not having it, having excessive amount of money, is not discussed in schools, particularly affluent schools. Yes, it is. See, I think every school should have a 45-minute period every morning before classes start to talk about these undiscussables. I think it should be part of the school curriculum. Call it what you like, social sciences, you know, whatever.
There are things
that affect kids that adults are not aware of or they don't have time to deal with, and so they don't ever discuss them. And that's one of them.
Mm.
Kids should have the opportunity to say, I feel badly because my mother could only spend $20 on gym shoes, and she couldn't. 180.
Okay, so you think that kids should be able to talk that about that sort of thing in what sort of platform?
I think in a private environment with their own peers in a classroom led by the teacher.
Right, yeah.
It's become a huge, big, embarrassing deal. It just becomes, well, hell, that worries me, you know. I feel a less of a person because, you know, I could only afford $20 shoes.
Mm. And it's really true. That status is...
You'll find that kids actually... I was in a school where a wealthy kid gave their Nikes to a poor kid.
Yes.
They didn't even know they cost $180.
Yes.
So I'm sure the parents were pissed off, but...
Yes.
What children are, which is positive. They don't want these differences. They're created by adults. That's my main point here.
Well, you're saying that the differences are created by adults. How are you saying that the differences are created by adults, Stuart, by their wealth?
Their wealth.
It's
not a malignant, I am out to make poor children feel bad.
No.
It's the fact that we have a huge difference in incomes between the rich and the poor in the public school system.
Mm.
You have the same thing in Australia.
Mm.
And unless this is openly dealt with in schools, it will interfere with children's capacity to learn.
Yes.
And really, I mean, if you don't believe that, then I don't know what to say to you, because unless a child is happy in school, they will learn. I don't care.
Right.
What
right.
So, you're teaching them. They will learn unless they're happy and these sorts of issues, undiscussable issues, are dealt with. And we're not even halfway down the list of undiscussables yet.
So when we start to discuss things, what's the psychological, what's the psychological benefit of this discussing? I just want you to say it.
You know what it is.
Yeah, I know the answers, but I want you to say them.
The answer is this. Poor children speak about what makes them feel embarrassed. Rich children, most of the time, will be unaware of this imbalance.
Yes.
And they will address it, not necessarily to the extreme of the rich child who gave his Nikes to the poor child that I just described to you, but may do something else about how they display their world. And I've had families where wealthy kids make their parents provide for poorer kids by getting involved with school help programs and doing things, giving some of their clothing and things to kids who are poorer, because kids don't see class distinctions.
No, like, we train them. That's the point.
If I could say anything critical on your program, this would be it. Children do not see class distinctions.
Mm.
Adults do.
Yes.
And when children see that their money is creating trouble with somebody they would like to be friendly with, they will change it. They will go back to their parents and say, I don't want to wear those sort of shoes. I want to have friends. I'm not interested in what sort of shoes. Now, there's a percentage of kids who will not do that, and they'll be nasty kids, and they'll be unpleasant. But my point is, the majority of kids don't recognize class distinction. That's something adults do. And so I think that will if adults recognize that, it will remedy this issue.
Yep. Sorry, I've just got some messages. I've just had to click some buttons here. So what's your next on the list, Stuart, Professor?
Well, one of the things in schools that I see that is often not discussed is size. Now, the classic issue, and, you know, it's in the United States, it's a huge issue at the moment, is obesity. So kids who are obese in schools don't get a fair deal.
It's another status thing. Slimness is tied, in our culture, slimness is tied to status. And
oh, yeah.
It's, yeah.
But the other thing is, we've found just recently, this is not yet published, short boys have a terrible trouble with bullying.
Well, they have so many cliches attached to their names too, don't they? Like the little man syndrome and of course that is...
Yeah, it's not been recognized before in schools as an issue. But we have found many short children, boys, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. not girls, boys, really feel overly bullied.
Mm. So...
You know, obesity and size.
Okay. And all sorts. It's really interesting. So talking about being fat, I know. Well, I've always been slightly overweight or extremely overweight, depending on how seriously I am about being fit or not. And I would say to somebody, oh, I'm too fat. And they go, you're not fat. And I'd go, don't be stupid. Like, why can't, like, people can't even say, yeah, you're fat. They say, oh, no, you're just big boned or you're just this or that. And I'd say, excuse me, but, you know, like, it was like, they felt as though if they were saying that I was fat, they were then going to be criticizing me, you know.
They would be thinking they would offend you.
Yes, thinking it was undiscussable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the same with short boys who may grow up into short men. Because short men often are quite aggressive and They like to adopt leadership roles, and they like to do things we
compensation.
Say to compensate for their smallness.
Yeah.
But these are issues that are not something you choose. I mean, if you choose an undiscussable,
yeah.
Example, if you decide to become overweight and start eating extraordinary amounts of food, and
yes.
then you become very wealthy and unpleasant, and you racially destroy everybody, then I have no sympathy with you.
What are you saying? If you decide to become fat, and then what happens?
To become wealthy, and
you decide to become wealthy,
and then you start to become really nasty about your wealth, and you make your children racist, and you make them display their wealth and speak to poor children in a negative way. I have no sympathy with you. That's a choice you make. The issue I'm talking about is these children are still under the umbrella of parents whom they worship. And I use the word worship deliberately. I mean it, worship, like God.
Mm.
I don't think most parents understand that. That's how children are.
It's true. So,
yeah. And so parents need to be able to let their children discuss their opinions and treat those opinions as worth listening to, which many parents do not.
That's true. So this really brings it back to another undiscussable, which is parenting courses. Like, so many of us don't want to admit that we need to learn more parenting skills.
Absolutely. And, you know, I see 1,000 times on these shows on television, reality shows and so on, parents who have no skills in parenting at all. They treat their daughters like siblings. They treat their sons like competitors. And, in many ways, it's frightening to me.
Well, Stuart, I had really bad parenting skills with my oldest son. I call him my test crash dummy. And people kept saying, look, you really should do a parenting course. And I go, oh, no, I don't need to do a parenting course. Anyway, I finally found Kate Birch's P5 parenting course, and I did it. And it was so much easier after I did a parenting course.
And those are helpful. But how many, let me put it this way, if your husband earns $1 billion a year,
Mm.
are you going to take a parenting course?
Yes, please. I would.
But majority of women would not do that. They would say, who can teach me? I mean, my husband is worth this much money. I'm a very important person in this community. By then, they'd be on all sorts of boards and all sorts of trusts and all sorts of everything.
Well, this brings us to narcissism.
Taught by some idiot who runs a parenting course.
Yeah. And that's just so narcissistic. And that brings us to another undiscussable. Like, narcissism is so prevalent in, I mean, we're all narcissistic, but, you know, when you get to the narcissism that's caused by sort of attachment damage, it's really complicated, isn't it? Let's talk about narcissism for a minute.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But, you remember the myth of Narcissus?
Yes.
From which Freud was like to extract some of his names from Greek myths, Oedipus and so on. And Narcissus was one. I don't know if you ever have a chance or you dig up your college books and you'll find a set of poems by Ovid called Metamorphoses. And one of them is Narcissus.
Yeah, I've read that. And Narcissus had Echo too, remember? He was...
That's the point.
Yes.
He didn't know he's cursed to respond only to his reflection or to repetition of what he just said by Echo. So in my opinion, he died from lack of feedback.
And right.
He fell into the water and turned into a beautiful flower. Well, I don't know if you've ever grown a narcissist, but the flower is easy to hurt. You touch it, it bruises.
Mm.
That's narcissism to an extreme degree. As you say, we all need some self-esteem, some narcissism, self-love. But when it becomes absorbed into you as a primary focus, it becomes an illness called narcissistic personality disorder. The people who present with that are almost always past middle age or at middle age, around 50 years of age. They very frequently belong to colleges and universities, and their primary complaint is, I've not achieved what I felt I should have, given my skills and knowledge. My marriage is okay, but not very good. I haven't got tenure, although I should get tenure. And my job is okay, and I have enough money, but it's not what it ought to be. I just feel like I'm not achieving what I should be achieving. This is the end point of narcissism that originally was too much and now is disappointing, because the individual who spent his whole life waiting to be discovered has not been discovered.
Right.
So he comes to see a shrink.
Right. And some people say that narcissism can't be cured, and yet
I think
mentalization would help, wouldn't it?
Well, narcissism is life-saving. You have to have narcissism. Mentalization helps you make it so it doesn't become too much. If it's too much, you're going to end up like this patient I just described.
Yeah.
He comes to you and says, why have I not got tenure? Why is my marriage not one of the best in the world? Why are my children not all famous? Here am I, I've devoted my life to academia and nothing has happened. What are you going to say to somebody like that? That's what I get. The narcissism you're talking about, I think, is there's a point with narcissism beyond which it becomes unrealistic. You see the world as only responsive to your thinking. One of the research workers, Peter Fonagy, called it a pretend world, where you say, everybody here believes as I do. I'm the very best person in this world, and I should get tenure, and I should become famous. And all I have to do that is work hard and think. And everybody will eventually agree with me. No. That's a phase you go through around about 18 months of age. After that, unless you see your own defects, your own lack of skill, and become humble, you're going to end up a very miserable person when you're middle age or older. Very miserable. Because nothing can satisfy a truly narcissistic illness. I know what you're talking about is not an illness. It's just part of normal development.
I'm talking about both. I'm talking about both. I just have to interrupt here because we did put up an image, and I'm wondering whether this image can, I mean, there are ways that we could sort of segue into that, and or do you think we might save it for another show? The CBA image, I think it was.
The circular thing? Yeah. Why not say that? If you want to ask me about specific projects you've done in different countries, that becomes essential because it's protection against narcissism in the community.
Well, this is what I was thinking. This is what I thought. Now's a good chance to say it. Yeah, how do narcissistic communities destroy themselves? And what can we do to get narcissistic, to overcome this narcissism, like using the same sort of psychoanalytical understanding that we use within the personality? How do you spread that out into the community?
How much time have we got?
Well, like, it's up to Stephen. Theoretically, we only have 14 minutes. We could go on forever. We've got 30 minutes.
30?
30, okay. Stephen?
See, here's what I was trying to say to you before, Jill.
Yes.
That whole topic. When you shift from this discussion, we've been.
Well, that's right. You're right. It was Stephen who typed it, and I respect him. But yeah, I'd rather stay on undiscussables.
Yeah, because
yeah.
Once we can get into community undiscussables and community issues.
Let's stick with that.
Next time.
All right. Well, let's just stick with undiscussables because okay, this is
now,
quite.
Here are a couple of undiscussables that are typically brought up. One is skin color and the other is religion.
That's right.
What we have found, oddly enough, is these are not really much of a problem.
Yeah.
They do influence, in one study we did in Jamaica, how black you were. And all Jamaican children are black, but the degree of blackness, if you were less black, you had more social status, put it that way.
God.
And religion really had no influence on children at all. None. And that's odd because, of course, as you know, reading the paper, it has enormous influence on everything every adult does, especially when they're fighting the jihad, you know? Children are interested.
Children are beautiful, aren't they?
No, they're not. They're not into that stuff. Appearances. What appearances you have. And so the skin color really is far less important as a cause of undiscussables in schools than money, how your teacher treats you, and your size, whether you're obese or short. In schools, those are the undiscussables. I mean.
Okay. So you're saying skin color doesn't matter?
I'm not saying it doesn't.
To the same degree.
It's not to the same degree. I mean, in a Jamaica study, how black you were was important.
Which is really interesting because that's a white construct anyway, isn't it? Like
a white construct. But far more important in Jamaica was what type of shoes you were wearing.
Yeah. Back to wealth.
Yeah. It's back to, are you wearing the shoes that fashionable and that wealthy Americans wear.
Yeah. I remember I was in a Buddhist monastery and there are a couple of Italian guys there and this Italian guy came in and he looked at he just walked up to the Italian guy and he looks at his T-shirt and he goes, Lacoste. That was his greeting. And I thought, this is insane.
I'm going to shoot away.
Okay, I'll let you shoot away for a minute and see what Stuart's gone off to get while we're waiting here. Stephen, do you have anything you want to say, Stephen? Are you with us at the moment or have you turned us off and let us run amok
on our own? No, I'm here.
Say something.
Did he take
a
break?
I beg your pardon?
Is he in a break?
No, he's gone to get something.
Oh,
Did we cue up that music that we were going to do?
No.
You didn't get that song?
You didn't send me a link.
Yeah, I did. I sent you... it doesn't matter anyway. I can find it again for you. I want to do that one, Brave. You know the song Brave?
Yeah.
It's probably in our stream there somewhere. So have you got any questions in particular you want to ask Stuart when he comes back?
Oh, maybe he can talk about... sexuality, you know, he happened to mention race and religion, but
yeah.
he didn't say anything about sexuality as a undiscussable.
Right. Well, we'll let him lead to it, I suppose.
Yeah. I can cut this all out of the show here.
Oh, can you?
Yeah.
All right. Well, that'd be good. Well, listen, this is the song. If you can put this in. Here it is. I'll put it in Skype. Now, I've got another message from somebody who I had to turn my Skype off. I worked out there's a turn-off button for it. Theo, that song there.
Okay.
That's right. We're going to cut this bit of the show out.
Well, he's
in the recording, so. We're going to tidy it up. Yeah.
So go ahead and continue now, Jill.
Well, listen, okay. Steve raised the issue of sexuality. And I've had that raised many, many times in the course of discussions on schools. What is the gender difference between this and that?
Yes.
In this issue, in this particular instance, it might be, what is the gender difference in terms of abuse that occurs between girls and boys based on things that are not obvious, that are not discussed? And I will say to you that I think gender issues below high school are almost irrelevant. Children are really developing a concept of sexuality below high school. It is true that many children in the United States of America, 7-year-old girls, about 30% of them show Tanner stage 1 signs of puberty. And it's around 40% with black girls. Most girls are having periods by the age of 9.
I got mine at 10. A
gynecologist. So, and they aren't really any different than any other child of 9, except they have periods. And boys lag behind girls considerably, both intellectually and physically. So girls are always brighter than boys in school until about the age of 18 or 20.
Mm-hmm.
Then boys catch up.
Interesting.
I'm sure you've noticed that in yourself, in your own schooling. But the issue around sexuality becomes an issue in high school when testosterone and estrogens have become a big part of a child's life. It's not undiscussable. It's right up there because it becomes prominent whether teachers want it or not. It's not of this issue of things that are sort of hidden, you know.
Right.
Are teachers really bullies? No, of course. What do you mean? A teacher shouldn't be a bully. What the hell does it matter whether I'm a foot shorter than my friend or not? Or what the hell does it matter what shoes I wear? These are issues that I'm considering undiscussable.
Yeah.
Sexuality is a big, big issue in high school. And, you know, it can be dealt with. It's not undiscussable. It's just, you know, it's discussable. It has to be discussed. If it's not discussed, the school will become a total mess.
What you're saying in your book is prejudice and stigma are extremely difficult to discuss as a matter of policy.
Now, you're getting into another area. When you have a school with a very mixed population, which is quite unusual in the United States, I don't know what it is like in Australia. In the United States, geographical locations are very specific. So rich people tend to live together and poor people tend to live together. And there are a few on the border that are, we've got one school that is a mixture of rich and poor, but it's very unusual. Now, in schools that are very poor, prejudice against race, not religion, race mainly, and in wealthy schools similarly, is a major issue. But the children almost never live in the same school. They hold the same prejudice that adults do from people that they don't see, don't have anything to do with, and don't live with. And then, when your classic Ku Klux Klan member comes in touch with a black man that he really likes, he becomes friendly with him and he says, well, he's not like all the other blacks I know. This is what happens in the United States all the time. I live near a town where the Grand Imperial Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan lives. And it's very...
That must be fun.
Black people there have a good time if they're okay with the Ku Klux Klan members. They love them.
They love the Ku Klux Klan members.
Absolutely, absolutely.
The black people do. The
thing about that town, which I won't mention, number of white children in juvenile reformatories for murder is very high. There's an enormously high violence rate in the children of Ku Klux Klan members. And that's another whole issue. But I'm saying race is an issue primarily for adults. It's not an issue for children in schools until they become sort of, 11th, 12th grade. Now they become mini adults and they're trying to emulate their adult issues. I'll give you an example specifically. I started work in a school in the inner city of a Midwestern area, half black, half white. There'd been an attempted rape of a second grade girl in a elementary school by a second grade boys. Seven of them were convicted of sexual assault. They've had the worst out-of-school suspension rate in the school district. Its academics were right at the bottom of the barrel. And we were called in there in a sort of emergency. And we worked with them intensely over a seven-year period to develop ideas that were then put into a randomized controlled trial that resulted in the work we've done with schools. That school, to this day, is a perfect school. If you went into
a perfect school,
absolutely. If you went into it, you would think from the amount of noise that the school had closed down for the day. It's so
quiet. Well, that's not always a sign of a perfect school.
No, it isn't. But this particular school, it is, because before it was utter chaos.
Right.
Play equipment is in perfect order. The grounds are in perfect order. The school itself, and remember, we didn't touch racial prejudice in the school.
What did you do? Tell us what the secret formula was.
Yeah, we intervened around the idea of the role of the bully, the role of the victim, and the role of the bystander to both.
Right.
And we put emphasis on the bystander, not the bully and the victim.
You know, the bystander is an undiscussable. Come to think of it, that is, I mean, it's discussed by you a lot, but pardon?
You're absolutely right. And let me finish the story and then we go on to bystander.
Yeah, go.
We didn't do anything with racial prejudice. Half the school were black and half white, roughly. And the Midwest, there was a small percent of Hispanic and Native American. After the project had finished its formal stage, the teachers, without being asked, said, racial issues are far less of a problem in this school.
Right.
They'd focused on where racial issues come from, which we think are from power struggles, not from color differences.
Mm.
What the hell is that?
Mm. I mean, it is. It's a power struggle for sure. So how do you get...
Silliest thing in the world is Ku Klux Klan guy with his little outfit on that makes him look like Casper the Ghost. I always thought as a kid he was Casper the Ghost. I don't know. He looks sort of silly.
It's really funny. I was just imagining a black guy in a Ku Klux Klan outfit. In my mind, I was thinking, I wonder how many black guys hide in that Ku Klux Klan outfit so they could go and be mean to somebody.
Well, I do. But the point I'm saying that racial prejudice really is not an issue of race. It's an issue of power. Mm. And it's an issue of who is in charge. And in a school, that will only become a racial... Below senior high school, below 10th, 11th, and 12th grade, mm-hmm. race is not an issue unless the school is infiltrated with, like, Ku Klux Klan or some adult racial group.
Unless it's taught.
Children are not racially prejudiced from birth. Not at all.
No.
I think that's very reassuring, in my opinion.
It is reassuring, isn't it?
You raise the issue of the bystander. I think it's an extremely interesting topic, which I hope we have time to talk about. I don't think of it as undiscussable, but it really is.
Mm.
We were among the first to bring this into the limelight in schools in the early 1990s. And the idea of it was this. We felt that when two kids fight in schools, one's called a bully and one's a victim, they don't do that just out of some nasty little argument between the two of them. There's a social component, and the way we saw that was we watched all the kids standing around with their cell phones taking pictures and talking about what they were looking at.
Mm.
Then we began to wonder, is this really a social phenomenon in which the bully shows off to his guard of adoring disciples, or does he show off to those who are not in his guard how powerful he is to try and get more people in his guard? And so we initiated the research to look at that, and we found that that was true, that in reality, the bully is a product. The bully is not the cause of violence in schools. He's a result of the violence in schools. The victim is not part of the cause of violence in schools. They are the victim of it. In other words, the cause of the violence does not lie in the bully and the bully's victim. Now, that's a true undiscussable. I'm glad you mentioned it. I just took it for granted. Because then the question becomes, well, who causes the bullying? Who causes the victim? Mm. But it also explains why all the efforts for the past 20 years or so have been a failure, have not helped the problem in schools at all. And I think that's because the cause of the problem has been located in the wrong place. In other words, if you treat the victim and you treat the bully, and that's not the cause, all that will happen is more bullies and more victims will come up and the problem will go on and on and on and on forever. The issue is in the bystander. Now, I think you read some of our work on bystanders. We came to this conclusion after spending $1 million on a randomized controlled trial involving 9 elementary schools and about 4,000 students. Mm. And we didn't look at bullies and victims at all. We looked only at the bystander. And significant shifts occurred in those schools by managing how the bystander steps in and becomes what became called upstander to prevent bullying, made a school unpleasant for all students.
Mm.
And those upstanders were not only children, by the way, they were also teachers, volunteers, lunch people, gym instructors, PE instructors. They were not defined as only children. They were anybody who said, I won't put up with this victimization of children. Stop.
Mm. Mm. And how do you... Go on.
Children learn that you don't do that just by yourself because you'll get hurt. But if you take 10 of your friends and you go up to a bully who's persecuting a victim and you say, stop it, he probably will.
Well, that's right. It ties in with the other ways in which we like to not discuss things, which is like, don't get involved, too much information, all these cliches that go around. And I'm wondering how much, from a psychoanalytic point of view, you can relate that to avoidant anxious and then explain that in a community-based or in a community sort of analysis of undiscussables.
Well, yeah, you've raised, I think, a very good point. There are lots of excuses the bystander group can use for not intervening. Now, what I'm going to do now is define the bystander group. And It's not only the kids at school and the teachers and all the volunteers and the parents.
Yes, yes.
It's everybody in the community, many of whom say the following, one way or the other. I pay my taxes.
Yeah.
And you're supposed to be a teacher, or you're supposed to be a community policeman who takes care of schools. So go do your job. Don't blame me for it. It's your problem.
Yeah. Stephen, now, the picture's frozen.
Well, what?
Yeah, go on. Oh, just the picture of you is frozen. Keep going. It might only be my computer.
It's your picture that's frozen.
Oh, sorry. Keep going then, Professor Twemlow.
Well, the issue is that attitude abdicates the responsibility of the individual to take part in what goes on in schools in the education of their children.
Can you repeat that, please? I'm just not properly tuned into that, and I want to understand what you're saying there.
What I'm saying is that teachers and policemen alone cannot keep a school safe. It has to involve the community around the school. In the research I mentioned to you, Jill, we went around the community and got people out of retirement. We chose men, and if you want to discuss why men rather than women, I'll tell you. But we got men involved with schools. We're sitting there, you know, worrying about being retired and irrelevant and dying, who got out into schools and had a great time. The color of their skin, it was absolutely irrelevant. And they got involved with their school. It became their school. The mayor of the community became deeply involved with these schools that we were experimenting with. And, you know, the point I'm trying to make here is the abdicating bystander group, which is all of us, has to take part in changing the way schools operate. If we become abdicating bystanders, schools will always be violent unless we are willing to participate in how a school operates. And how a school operates is another one-hour talk. I'm sorry, Joel and Steve.
So that's very interesting. Stuart, you just absolutely have so many fascinating things to say. What I'm really interested in, we have to sort of round it up now and finish off.
Okay.
So I'm wondering how you'd like to tie all of that to how people being afraid to discuss things creates more problems rather than less problems.
Well, just
in summary.
Well, I mean, in summary, Jill, if, for example, you are wanting to simply say, I pay my taxes and teachers should teach and police should take care of the safety of children in school, which is the big issue in the United States. I think the police are not as involved in Australia, but many countries they are involved. And if you want to keep that fantasy in operation, it will work as until something awful happens in schools, and those awful things are suicide and homicide.
Yes.
It's happening with increasing frequency in the United States. There are 3 to 10 homicides a year in schools in North America. There are quite a few suicides, often in children who are transgender or have sexual identity issues. So if you don't, if you're not willing to step out of that role, you're going to impair the quality of your children's education. So do you want to do that or not? The issue, I think, that would be interesting would be to set up some sort of networking group that can find a way to help people not have to take full responsibility for things like teaching or safety, but to help people. I mean, in the United States, children may get criminal accusations delivered by policemen for things like causing trouble in the classroom, for skipping school. They get a criminal record for that. That's now changing because nobody wants to take responsibility. And my point is, and hopefully through what you and Steve are doing, is to suggest that unless we take responsibility for the way schools operate, we will produce children who hate learning and hate school. And those sort of children will not be good citizens for the 21st century. I feel I'm not talking about stuff that requires an IQ of 190 or 200 to understand. It seems obvious to me. So why don't we do it? Why don't we get involved? There's in the United States, there's thousands of spouses, male and female, who are now at home. More and more men are now taking care of the home and children while their wives work. They could be involved with the way schools operate. They just don't see a role there because our social structure has not defined that role. I don't know what Australia was like. You can tell me. I've noticed Australian men seem much more happy taking their children around and playing with their children. I thought that was rather touching about Australia. Unless men are different there, it's going to be something women are going to have to share with men, the role of taking care of the society. Because what they have to see is society. The society is what determines how children are trained at school. It's not the quality of teachers and whether they happen to have the latest reading program from some academic somewhere else in the world. It's not that. It's their social and emotional education.
And that's, you know, that's just so important. The importance of being able to talk to each other is the basis of the relationship between the husband and wife, the relationship between the father and son, the relationship between the school and the teacher, the relationship with everybody. So learning to discuss the undiscussables, learning to talk about it is one of the most important things that we can do. So,
and, you know, you've done it. In the course of a few times we've met, you've talked about your own defects in parenting. You've talked about your own problems you've had and facing issues in yourself. And you haven't asked me, of course, because, you know, I'm the sort of super expert. But if you were to ask me about my defects, you'd be astounded about how many of them there are. I may not be astounded, but whatever it is, there are plenty of them. You see, these are things I think people need to be willing to admit they're defective.
Yes, yes, yes. And I do. I think that's really important. To confess our faults is one of the most fabulous things we can do. So thank you so much, Professor Twemlow. I hope we can get you back to confess more of your defects very soon.
Let me know, Jill. Let me know.
Well, we'll just wind up now and finish this, but we'll talk off air. So Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure and a delight as usual.
Thank you.
Very informative. Thank you.